And good afternoon. It's just a few seconds after 4 o'clock, and thanks for tuning in to CFRC 101.9 FM. We are located in Lower Carruthers Hall, Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario. My name is Bruce. This is Finding a Voice, a spoken word program airing here every Friday afternoon from 4 to 6 o'clock. We do stream live online as well at www.cfrc.ca. And coming up on this show today, in the first and well into, in fact, about two-thirds of the way into the second hour, you're going to hear a not-yet-aired-on-this-show event from a September 26, 2024, Kingston Writers Fest event called Two Bookish Broadcasters Walk Into a Bookstore an Afternoon with Eric Friesen and Sheila Rogers. You'll hear their conversations about and their ideas as well about reading, writing, authors, books in prisons, and working in their years, I guess, on the air. It is, again, a 92-minute discussion or conversation, and will run uninterrupted into and nearly, again, two-thirds of the way through the second hour. In the bit of time that remains in the second hour today, you'll hear me share from a list of upcoming deadlines, and calls for submissions, and also upcoming events here, along with other information. First thing, though, I would like to share my heartfelt thanks again to all who supported our funding drive in November and December. And in the event that any of you didn't get a chance and still wanted to, with the federal government's ruling about charitable donations, you can still donate and get a 2024 tax receipt until February 28th. So what we've done is we've extended the funding drive's deadline until then, just to allow that in case that's something that you might be interested in. And my usual, I'll start with my usual start of the hour announcement. It is occasionally that some poetry, spoken word, or music played on this show may contain strong language, but all is played in its entirety with content unedited to honor the creative integrity of both the author and the piece. And have a second announcement. Just because I won't have a chance to work this in at the usual, it's an end of the hour announcement that I do every week in both hours of the show. So I'm just going to announce it now, since we're going to run straight through that by a long shot. And it's just a reminder that every week, both hours of this show are uploaded to my personal blog space for it at Finding a Voice on CFRCFM.wordpress.com. Shows will remain there for 3 years. And usually, if I don't have any glitches, I usually get those uploaded by about 7 o'clock after I get home from the show. So, just in case you tuned in a few seconds late, I'm just going to announce it again and just kind of say, here we go. Again, from a September 26, 2024 Kingston Writers Fest event called Two Bookish Broadcasters Walk Into a Bookstore an Afternoon with Eric Friesen and Sheila Rogers. Let's go ahead. I've mentioned what you're going to hear, but you're going to hear it if you stay tuned. So it does run, I will repeat, 92 minutes. So well into the second hour, but we'll run uninterrupted. And you know what? I feel like I've said enough here, but I'm not sure what's going on here. Let's go ahead and see if this does it. Here we go.
Hello, everyone. First of all, please forgive me for wearing a mask. Unfortunately, I'm one of the many, I think, beset by a germ this time of year. So, if I'm sweating too, it's warm in this room, but I promise I'm not terribly infectious. I want to welcome you to this very special event. I also want to welcome you to the second day of Kingston Writers Fest this year. This is our 16th anniversary, and I'm delighted to be here on stage today as the artistic director of the festival. My name is Ara McCauley. It's wonderful to see such a beautiful crowd here today, and not surprising given the guests that we're about to have up on our stage. It's been an absolute pleasure to have the opportunity to work with Book Clubs for Inmates the last couple of years, and to collaborate with them, and to honor a very important and special part of the Kingston Writers' Fest community with Eric Friesen. Just a little bit about those of you. I would like to offer a land acknowledgement at this time. Kingston Writers' Fest acknowledges that Kingston remains on the traditional territory of the Huron-Wendat, Anishinaabe, and Haudenosaunee Confederacy. These Indigenous peoples called this land home before the arrival of settlers, and still call it home today. We acknowledge the presence of these nations and other First Nations, Métis, and Inuit who share this land today. And we agree to share, learn, and live peaceably along with and in support of these different communities. This event is 2 hours long and includes a Q&A. As you see, there is a microphone in the middle here, so when the question and answer period comes, if you can please make your way there to ask your questions. There are many sponsors that make the festival possible, and we'd like to thank some of them here. That includes the Canada Council, Canadian Heritage, Ontario Arts Council, Experience Ontario, and the City of Kingston and Kingston Arts Council for their ongoing support. Thank you also to our festival media sponsors, WeRoar TV, Post Media, Profile Kingston, and CFRC. We're grateful to the many organizations and individuals who support the festival. For this event, we would especially like to thank Marriott Kingston Market Square, who is the event sponsor of this event, Sheila's Book Club, the author patrons of Sheila Rogers, and Book Clubs for Inmates, community partner for this event. Finally, a heartfelt thanks to our dedicated volunteers, some of who have joined us just this year and some of who have been part of the festival's family for over a decade. They are the best. So a reminder, if you haven't done so already, to please turn off any devices that make noise or could interrupt this session in any way. We also encourage you to fill out a comment card for a chance to win great prizes, including a festival pass for next year. And if you go to our online survey at Kingston Writers Fest, you have an opportunity to win the window, which is all of the books in the Novel Idea window. If you haven't seen that display, it's absolutely beautiful. And now I'd like to turn this over to Tom Best with Book Clubs for Inmates. Tom.
Thanks so much. So my name is Tom Best. I'm the executive director of Book Clubs for Inmates. I don't know how many in the audience might be volunteers. If you are, would you stand up? I know Jan Walter's here. Jan? Yeah. And Eric? Oh, great. A whole bunch of people. That's great. Thank you very much for coming. Before I start, I do want to, somebody who was not thanked in that wonderful introduction was Ara herself. She's an amazing festival director, and you're very lucky to have someone of her ability and stature here in the city. So, Ara, thank you. And thank you. So how did this idea ever come out about? Well, we had a very informal meeting at Morrison's, which I'm sure everybody in this room knows. And Jan came up with, or suggested that perhaps if we were looking for a fundraising idea, it might be kind of fun to have somebody interview Eric Friesen, one of our longest serving volunteers. And I had had an interesting thing happen just that week. I had been told by Sheila Rogers that she was going to accept our invitation to come onto our board at Book Clubs for Inmates, and I was thrilled with that news, and I said, I know the perfect person. She Sheila Rogers. She will be coming back here and it'll be perfect. About a week later, after we all agreed and Nora was gracious enough to say, yes, let's do it. I'm sure she thought it was a crazy idea and would never get off the ground. And I would never convince Sheila to come be here to the east. I got a call from Sheila Rogers, rather mysteriously saying to me, Tom, I'm sorry, but I have bad news and good news. I have accepted a position which I can't tell you about, but it disallows me from being on your board. So it's my pleasure today to introduce the shortest serving board member, Sheila Rogers, your new chancellor here at Queen's. The longest serving volunteer in our 16-year history, Eric Friesen. This is billed as a fundraising event, and I do want to just make a quick plea. We are in our 16th year, as I've mentioned, and it was actually started here at Collins Bay by a remarkable woman named Carol Finley, who went on to expand it right across the country, and I've been the lucky person who has inherited this incredible organization filled with volunteers right across Canada. We're now in 44 different book clubs. We offer a program, for those of you who've had a chance to look at the brochure, we offer a program for incarcerated parents to read to their children and send the book and the recording home every month. And we also have been embarked on this ambitious plan to provide 500,000 books to libraries in prisons right across the country. And so far we're at just under 100,000 books. And we plan to do that in the next 3 years. So it's an ambitious goal. And after the pandemic and where we started to get traction again, we're getting requests now from provincial jurisdictions and other things like that. It's great news. And it's encouraging to know we've got a room full of readers here and that that sort of reading tradition is very strong within prisons. But we are really struggling, I think, to try and keep up with the demand, and we need funds from particularly communities like this where there are so many prisons. We have 9 book clubs in this area alone. I'm just asking those of you who came in and grabbed a brochure, or if you didn't, please take one away. For those of you who are interested in making a donation by mail, there are these things at the back of the room, and some of you managed to walk away with those bags that were up front for book clubs for inmates. Would you please put them back, unless you'd like to make a donation, because there's a QR code. Don't ask me how this works, but apparently if you just put your camera up to your phone up to it, it will take you directly to the donation page, and then you can take one of those bags. And I haven't told them this yet, but I think if you really want them signed, I think I know 2 people, although they don't have books currently, they would be delighted to sign those bags for you. Finally, I really am here in sort of a pretense, because honestly, the 2 people that are about to conduct the conversation on stage really don't need any informal introduction. I will do this just because we created this and I was given sort of instructions as to what to actually say about each of these people, some of whom you might not even recognize, but you would certainly recognize their voices. Sheila Rogers. Sheila Rogers is a veteran broadcast journalist, most recently at CBC Radio as the host and co-creator of The Next Chapter. She's the award-winning, it's an award-winning program that's devoted to writing in Canada. Last June, after 43 years at the CBC, Rogers retired and decided it was time to start her own Next Chapter. In 2011, she was inducted as an honorary witness for the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. That same year, she was named as an officer, I'm assuming of the Order of Canada. Yes, I'm right. And she is the Chancellor Emerita of the University of Victoria, a member of the Métis Nation of Greater Victoria, and was the 2022 Simons medalist. She's also got that Queen's gig I was telling you about. Erin Friesen is a broadcaster, writer, speaker on music and culture and faith in both Canada and the United States. He was a network host and executive for CBC Radio as well, and Minnesota Public Radio, NPR. For CBC, he hosted such programs as Studio Sparks, On Stage at Glenn Gould Studio, in performance, as well as a celebrated documentary series, The Concerto According to Pinchas, and The Concerto According to Manny, among many others. In 2019, Erin Friesen was also appointed as a member of the Order of Canada. I can't think of two more people who have been more important in encouraging a culture of reading in this country and in inspiring and promoting Canadian authors and great literature than these two. Please welcome National Literary Treasures, Sheila Rogers and Erin Friesen.
Such a regal ring.
I have a very large ring. Would you like to kiss it? It does have a regal ring.
It does.
Really?
It does.
And I like the robes. They're fantastic. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. They're a little hot for a day like today.
But, yeah.
You know, you can hide a lot of kids underneath. It's like the old fairy tale.
Or a drink or whatever.
Or a drink or a picnic.
Yes, perhaps.
On Wolf Island. Yeah.
Shall we start in a lighter vein? I know really.
Was that happy?
Aren't you all so up? You know, when you do a speech, you're always supposed to start.
Yeah.
So my first question for you, Sheila, is: what was the most embarrassing moment you've ever experienced on the radio?
Oh, wow. There's so many. Well, this would have to be. You wouldn't have heard this, Eric. But I was interviewing, I've never ever talked about this in public, but I was interviewing Peter Mansbridge. And I think, maybe it was his 60th anniversary of the CBC or something like that. It was 20 years ago, do the math. And it was going very, very well. And we had a little break at the bottom of the clock for local news and information. And during that time, I said to Peter, and only he could hear me, I really wish you could stay longer. I've just got a couple of boring people talking about seniors and using the internet, which is actually something I would love to know as a senior. I would really love the assistants, and they heard me. So it was just awful, and I just had to grovel, and it was...
What did you do?
Well, as soon as I realized, I could see the face of my studio director dropped to the floor. But it was actually mortifying more than embarrassing, I suppose. But I've had other embarrassing moments. But again, I've been saved by my producers. When I had long COVID, I lost filters. I lost the ability to just sort of comb out the stuff that no one should hear. And I might have called someone an effing...
We get them.
And my lovely guest said, be that as it may. What about you?
Well, I guess I'd have to go back to an earlier time in my broadcasting career. And I would say about 1975. Do you remember when Canada went metric?
Yes, I do.
You do. Yeah. So many people here are of an age that can remember that. So there I was at CBW in Winnipeg doing Radio Noon, the noon show. And I was really pissed off about this. I did not want... I hated the whole idea of going metric. I was from Manitoba, you know? Everything is miles and, you know, all beautifully laid out. I just hated the thought of it. So I was grumbling. The day we were supposed to start announcing Celsius temperatures, and I think maybe kilopascals, and I was grumbling. And I had this very crazy friend
and Brian Slemming. Did you ever know him?
I remember he worked at Northern, CBC Northern.
He did. He was also in sports for a while. Yeah. He was a real character. He said yes, and he said, not only do we have to do that, he said to me, sucking me right in, he said, we're going to have to announce Celsius time. And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, you know, it's coming up to 1 o'clock. It'll be 1300 Celsius time. So guess what this crazy guy did? He announced Celsius time several times. I said, 1410 Celsius time. So poor Maggie at the switchboard at CBW, you know, the phones are, the wires are melting. People are saying, tell that idiot. And so the call went up to the fifth floor at CBC was there. Irene Carter was the producer of the morning show. She just happened to be there smoking a cigarette. So she takes the calls, and so she says, she comes down, rushes down, and she says to our producer, who shall remain nameless, because she said to him, you gotta tell him to stop. And he said, he was scared of us. So scared of Brian and me. So he said, you go tell him. So she came in, of course, talk about being mortified. I chased that itch all over the CBC. Celsius time. My most embarrassing moment.
Well, I'm so glad you mentioned time, because I remember Eric hosting the Winnipeg New Music Festival. Huge, huge success festival and presenting new music. It was obviously fabulous. So Eric would come out before we went live, before the live broadcast began, and he would say, no, it may be 7 o'clock here, but it's 9 o'clock on the East Coast, and then it's 8 o'clock in the Eastern time zone. And I yelled out, what time is it in Altona? Which is where Eric's from. And Eric said, it doesn't matter.
No.
It doesn't matter. It's always 1956. Talking about Altona, I almost made it there last Sunday. I was hoping to surprise you, but I now live in Winnipeg. But tell me about Altona and how it shaped who you were.
Well, it's a town in southern Manitoba. It's certainly when I was growing up, it was almost, I would say, 98% Mennonite. A prosperous town. A town that has gone from, when I was there, from about 1,500 people out to 4,500. You know, it's really done very well. But it, as I say, it was a Mennonite town, so it shaped me as a kid growing up in a large extended family. Shaped me as someone who was certainly formed by the ideals of the people. You know? And also, well, because my father was a businessman, but he was a record collector, so I grew up listening to music. That's where I got my classical music training. And then in 1957, when I was 11 years old, a classical music station came to town. They started all these very idealistic Mennonite men thought, well, if you can't beat them, join them. You know, so we're not going to run away to Bolivia, not this one, because we were liberal Mennonites. And so they would start a radio station, which was half classical music, half religious program. So of course, you know, I the romance of radio hit me like a juggernaut.
How old were you?
I was 11 years old. I wasn't on the air yet, but eventually I was. So you know, it was a wonderful place to grow up, a wonderful large family, lots of opportunities, and of course the prairie is such a beautiful place to be.
I love it. I'm surprised at how much I love it. Yeah.
Well, you know, everybody retires to the West Coast, and you go the other way. Is it just because you're obstinate?
Yes. Yeah. That may be part of it. I lived on the West Coast for 20 years and broadcast all of the next chapter from Gabriel Island, and then a little studio in our house in Victoria, and we needed a change somehow. I think we were getting very comfortable on the West Coast. That's fine. But I think both my husband Charlie and I decided we need to shake things up a little bit. And he said, I know, Winnipeg.
And he's from Newfoundland, isn't he?
He's actually from Reading, England.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Sometimes he sounds like he's from Newfoundland.
Okay.
Charlie has very good friends in Winnipeg, and I've got friends, I also have relatives. And this is a bit of a story, but it turns out my father was Métis, and I didn't know that until after he died in 2008. And my aunt brought over a long scroll of the family tree, and there were quite a number of women who didn't have last names, and I asked her why, and she said, well, they were Native, dear. And I said, well, I'm going to find out who they are. I want to know who they are. I went to Winnipeg in 2010 to do some research in the archives, and I liked the city then, Eric. There was something about it. I just felt an energy, and people make their own mischief, and anyway, I've decided Charlie's got a good idea, so we're going to move to Winnipeg, and I'll find out who my family is. And I'm meeting them, which is really wonderful. It's they're all crazy, so I know we're related.
What happened to you? What happened inside of you when you realized that you were mating?
That's a great question.
You know, I mean, we always thought of you as the ultimate wasp. The ultimate Ottawa wasp, because we knew your mom.
Well, yes,
you know,
yeah.
Was.
She really was. You know? She was a very proud Anglican, and spoke. Most people thought my mother was from England, and she was from Maniwaki, Quebec. She worked very hard to get rid of the accent that she had. But when I found out, I felt. I didn't really find out until 2010, 2011, but I felt a certain resonance. On the air, I've been doing stories about Indigenous communities and issues and success stories for a long time. And I think something just kind of fell into place, like there was a missing part of the puzzle. I learned that Murray Sinclair, the Chancellor Emeritus of Queens, was my cousin. And we have lots of Sinclairs in our family. And in fact, when I told him that I think we share a great-great-great-grandmother, he said he was at Nahue Sinclair, and he pulled out $5 from his back pocket and said, you probably haven't had any treaty money, have you? So that's the treaty annuity. But then, in wonderful Murray fashion, he made me give the $5 back. He ripped it in half and said, here, you take this part. I'll give you the other half when you show me your documentation. Did he ever do that? No.
He didn't.
He didn't, because he said the half five makes him laugh. So that's fine with me. But it's... You know how you're from a great family of lots of people. I didn't know I had such a big family. Now they're not, you know, they're not brothers and sisters, but they are cousins and aunts and uncles and people removed, I guess, a little bit. What I want to ask you about, back to Altona, and I've never thought of you as the ultimate wasp. I haven't, but
thank you.
You're welcome. But your values are showing, Eric. In almost everything you do, your values come through. And is that because of how you grew up in Altona?
Well, you know, as a growing up Mennonite, I wouldn't, you know, you're never supposed to advertise anything. You never speak of your values. You just show them, right? I had a Mennonite father-in-law who said, when somebody asked him, you know, was he a Christian or was he born again or saved? He'd say, don't ask me, ask my neighbor, which is a great answer, right? And I sort of feel, anyway, since you asked me, I will. I think what formed for me was a sense of service. My father was very much involved in the Mennonite Central Committee. Okay.
Yes.
The Mennonite Central Committee, which is a great relief organization. So we had people in and out of our house all the time. We'd been all over the world, but this was all very much in the form of service. You know, service was something that you just did, and it was a part of it. And yes, you could
have a career and so on, but always had to serve. I think that was the biggest thing that I learned. That and the whole notion of welcome. You know, people were always welcome in our house, you know, and I guess that's about it. I'm embarrassed to talk about this, really, because my mother, I can hear my late mother saying, "Who do you think you are?" You know, that was the sort of the message to us. But anyway, that's me.
You've described yourself as a Manglican.
A Manglican, yes. I'm a Mennonite who is now an Anglican. So there are lots in Winnipeg, by the way, lots in Winnipeg. So it may seem like a strange leap to go from being a Mennonite to being an Anglican, but in fact, I grew up in a religious atmosphere which placed a lot of emphasis on gravitas, you know, on a sense of very simple ceremony, but ceremony. So, and of course, Mennonites, you know, you grow up singing in four parts. We would sing grace on Sundays in four parts. So music was very important. So for me, the attraction to the Anglican Church now is music, the word, the prayer book, Thomas Cranmer's prayer book, and of course the liturgy. So that's what attracts me. For all the difficulties one has with organized religion, I guess I decided a long time ago I'd rather be inside than outside. So that's me. I'm a Manglican. There's lots of them in Winnipeg, I can tell you. St. Margaret's Anglican Church in Winnipeg is primarily Mennonite, you know. And how about you? I mean, you said you were raised an Anglican.
Yes, I was raised as an Anglican. I grew up in Ottawa, and I attended St. Matthew's Anglican Church. Does anyone feel like they're in the worst dentist's office in the world? we're going to pursue. We're just going to persevere. That's what we'll do. But the music, even as a kid, I loved the music. And I used to go and watch the organist who became a great conductor named Brian Law. And I know you knew Brian very well. But I liked to watch his feet on the organ pedals. And I couldn't believe he was so athletic as he played the organ. And what the sounds that he coaxed out of the St. Matthew's Boys Choir, I just felt like I was in heaven. I really did. But then I kind of fell out a little bit with the church. I think I had friends of different religions. I was interested in their faith and how they expressed it. But I was 17 years old. I was in a car accident. I went through a windshield and came to, with people telling me it was a miracle that my face wasn't all cut up and that I didn't have a huge concussion, though I did have one. But I thought, well, if it's a miracle, I think I better investigate that. And I did. And so I decided to go back to church and be confirmed as an Anglican. And there are all these kids who were 10 or 11 and me at 17. And I remember William, Bishop of Ottawa, saying, "What does joy mean to you?" And I'm thinking, well, it means happiness. And perhaps it means a deep contentment or an exuberant. You know. And he said, "No, it means Jesus, others, yourself, J-O-Y. And I've actually never forgotten that. But yourself is the last part. It's others and the greater power. I think right now, what I'm exploring is probably more indigenous at that moment. And I feel very moved by ceremony, by being smudged. There are a whole bunch of ceremonies I participated on the West Coast. But I do believe there's a bigger power, a greater power, I really do.
Let's talk about books. I mean, we're here with a whole ballroom full of readers, and you and I have been very much involved with books. Did you grow up with books?
Yeah, I did. I was a good reader inside, I wasn't a good reader. I couldn't read out loud. I had a lot of trouble, mixed up letters, but I was read to by my mother, who you knew, and she just had such a lovely voice, and she really liked to read stories out loud to us, and fairy tale stories, but I really loved animal stories, too. What about you?
Well, my parents didn't read to us, and we're in a town without a library, but the family business did have a small bookstore, so there were books. Our house was full of books. My dad was a reader. He was a member of the Book of the Month Club when he was a younger man. So there were all, so, and I wasn't really very interested in kids' books. I did read the Hardy Boys, you know, all of them, I think. But very quickly, I started reading my father's books. And I remember, I don't think I understood a tenth of it, but reading All's Quiet on the Western Front, you know, can you imagine? But that, but, and I, years later, I learned that actually it's quite good for young people to start reading adult books, even if they don't understand them, because you get out of that childish kind of thing. So I did very quickly, and I read, you know, read books like that, and I was allowed to. I don't think my mother knew what was in them, so that was fine. We could actually read them, but and we weren't read to, but I did read a lot. I remember I rocked when I read, and wore a hole in the, or kind of a, in the, in this sort of armchair we had, you know, because I would rock and I would read. I just loved to read, and I have ever since, you know.
You bring back such a great memory for me too with Book of the Month Club. So every month a book would come in a cardboard
sleeve,
exactly. And it's how people built a library. Very, very often it was. And you know, you go to a party, and if you remember the Book of the Month Club, you had something to talk about. And I remember sneaking in to read those books as well, Eric. But I think, back to loving animal stories, we had a dog for a little while, and I really love this dog. I've been dog crazy my whole life, and my father brought me this dog because I was very sick, and I believe the dog helped to heal me. And one day, I came back after piano lessons to find that my dog wasn't there. My mother had taken the dog to a farm, and that's not a euphemism, she really had taken him to a farm. It was a big dog. Us kids couldn't really handle it, and my parents were too busy to really give the dog the exercise that they needed. But I went right back to school, and I sat on the steps, and I just cried. And not long after, the librarian came out and asked me what was wrong. And I told her, and she said, come with me. And she took me into the library. It was 10 at the time. And she pulled out all the dog books that she could find and said, you can always find dogs in the library. And I just, the libraries are so, so, so important.
They are.
Yeah.
That's true. Yeah, I remember, I think the first time I came alive in a book was reading Return of the Native. It was, you know, and our school system was really good that way. We read Hugh McLennan, Watching It Into Night. I remember particularly Hardy's Return of the Native, because I fell in love with Eustacia Vye. Eustacia Vye was the great heroine of Return of the Native. And that's when I began to realize what the value of books are, because books take you to places and to meet people that you would never meet otherwise, or never have met, right? And that is fiction, particularly. That's the great value of fiction. And so that started me in a lifetime of going to places that I would never have gone to, haven't gone to, wouldn't be able to go to, and meeting some of the great characters that have been created by great writers. So that to me was always the, and that's where my love of books started, and ever since, I mean, a wash in books. So tell me who, you've interviewed every author on the face of the earth, right?
As long as they're Canadian.
Oh, you've interviewed others too. Favorite authors?
Always a difficult question. And I still really, really love Alistair MacLeod. If you haven't read Alistair, you have. Okay. I think he's like our Chekhov. And every year I reread his stories. I go to Cape Breton and I bring there's now a collection called Islands, and that you can find all his short stories in that one volume. They're different every year. Every year I read them. And I think that's the sign of a classic to me, but it's also the sign of endurance and how, you know, you bring whatever you are at the moment to what you're reading. So I'm a big fan of his. Romantic Mystery, I love Romantic Mystery. He hasn't written a book for a very long time, but if he did nothing but write A Fine Balance, I'd be okay. It is just one of the most sublime novels ever. And I'm a big fan of Louise Penny. She's a really good pal. I'm really glad she's a good writer. It would be awful if she weren't, but she's fantastic. And then my late chosen brother, Richard Wapakis. But there are, I used to find, I love that. I love the last book that I read. You know, that became a favorite, and I want to think about it for a while. What about you, Eric? Yeah, you've read very widely, and I suspect more internationally than I have.
Well, I don't know. I certainly have read internationally. And I was thinking before I came today, how do I boil this down? You know, I mean, I'm 10 years older than you are, Sheila. I've read since I was a kid, and so where do I start? But yeah, I love guy writers, you know. Uh-huh. John Irving, I don't know if we can call him Canadian, he's sort of partly.
Oh, he's got a citizenship.
He does have a citizenship.
Yes,
good.
Yeah.
Good, I'm glad to hear that. Well,
dual, I think.
Yeah, dual, okay. And A Prayer for Owen Meany, I think, is one of the great books that I especially at Christmas, I like to reread that section where the whole Christmas pageant comes. You know, there's this guy suspended, the angel is suspended from the ceiling, and he can't come down. And it's a send-up of every Christmas Sunday school program you've ever wanted to be. It's just brilliant. Just love that. I have to admit, I can't quite explain why, but I love the late English writer Anita Bruckner.
She's a wonderful writer.
I love Anita Bruckner. And every October, and it's coming up, I reread Hotel du Lac, which she won the Booker Prize, which I consider one of the great novels that I've ever read. This is just me. I just love this. Because it's a book about making a choice to lead an authentic life, which I think is the challenge for all of us, to lead an authentic life. And it's, you know, and she takes me to a world that I would never enter, ever, ever, ever. But every year I've been at now 11, 12, 13 times. You know, just love that. And I'll tell you one more. I mean, there are so many to talk about, and I feel like I'll have left out so many. But there's this wonderful Chinese writer. Do you know about him? Tan Tuan Eng, Chinese writer from Malaya, who's written three novels, and the greatest one, I think, is called The Garden of Evening Mists. And it's about a Japanese garden that's created before the Second World War on the island of Penang in Malaya. I knew nothing about Malaya before and it was Ben McNally who recommended it. I'm standing in the store when it was still on Bay Street, in the Virtue of Bookstores, I mean, come on. I'm standing there, I'm saying, Ben, I need something to read. And he just picked it out, and I'd never heard of it. And it's one of the most beautiful books I've ever read. The Garden of Evening Mists. It's a book you will never be sorry, ever, that you paid for and read.
Isn't it wonderful when there's a bookseller that can do that for you? And I think we're very, very lucky in this country that the quality of independent bookstores. Kingston, I mean, Prospero Books, was it? Barbara Allen and Wayne Oakley. It was Prospero when they were in Ottawa. I'm sorry, I don't know what it was called here. Right, thank you. Printed Passage. Yeah, I mean, beautifully curated. Now Ben McNally is, he's someone I really love and admire. And he was working in a bookstore on Front Street, Nicholas Hoare Books.
Right.
And
they sold CDs as well.
They did indeed. They did indeed. And I went in and said, he said, "What are you looking for?" I said, "I'm looking for a book that will change my life." And
there's a test.
He pulled out The Master and Margarita by Mikhail Bulgakov. And you know that, but then he would send me, I paid for them, but a box of 10 books to read every summer. And he really expanded my world, and he introduced me to Richard Ford, which was a gift.
Yes.
The American writer. Yeah, it was such a gift.
A sports writer.
Yes, yeah. Exactly.
Wonderful book.
Independence Day.
Yeah, Independence Day.
Yeah.
Canada.
Yeah, just wonderful. But I have to tell you about Richard Wagovitz. The first time I met him was in 1994, and I was working on a program called The Arts Tonight, and I had a wonderful producer, and his name was Richard Handler. He produced the books. And he had a script all ready for me to go, introducing Richard. And the pronunciation, I read the introduction with the pronunciation I'd received and said, "And now I'm delighted to welcome Richard Wagamese."
Great Canadian Italian, right?
The full Italian. And Richard just looked at me and said, "It's not Wagamese, it's Wagamese." He just, at that moment, a friendship was formed. But Eric, that interview taught me a lot. I've played it. It's actually quite mortifying because we were about the product, the artistic product. We weren't, in 1994, about the story behind it in a way that I think we are now. We weren't as comfortable going there, I think, as national broadcasters. But he was telling me that the story of Keeper was really based on his life and how he was searching for identity. And I just cut him right off in the middle of a sentence and went right back into the book. And I wasn't listening. And I think I got a little bit better 20 years later when I talked to him about Medicine Walk. But this is going to be the pursuit of my life, is listening, just giving everything you've got to it.
Well, this is the thing about interviewing, isn't it? You have half of your brain is a plan,
yeah.
The other half is listening,
yes.
And the plan changes.
Yes, that's right.
That's why it's a skill.
Yeah, very, very nice thing about it.
Yeah. I remember my very first author interview on CDO in Ottawa, where I started. Earl Burney, you know, the great Earl Burney, and the poet Earl Burney. We had in high school, we had read the David, you know, this great poem. So Earl Burney walks and shakes my hand and says, "Am I doing this for love or money?" And I was so deflated. I was so deflated. I thought we were going to be speaking on a high literary vein. And I said, I think for love and promotion. I can't even remember, but it, you know, I had to sort of pick myself up off the floor and then do an interview, which he did. I mean, he was gracious about it. Have you ever interviewed a writer whose book you didn't like?
Yes. Yes, I have. And I remember Peter Zosky telling me that you may have a great conversation about a book that you don't like, or that frankly isn't really great, and people will come back to you and say, "Hey, I bought that book." And, oh man, like come on, you know. But it was a good conversation. I've really tried to push out of the genres that I'm comfortable in. Until recently, I wasn't a great reader of fantasy or horror, but those were books I had to read on the next chapter, and I didn't necessarily like them, but I did enjoy the conversation. And by and large, there would be someone, we had a very, still is, Jacqueline Kirk is the producer, and she, I think, has very, very good taste. She's a very good gatekeeper, very good curator. But there are books, yeah, that you have to find something, right? And Yeah, there have been times that I've struggled. There have been times I thought, really, this one in a word? But, you know, I can now express that opinion, but well, actually, I don't know if I can as a chancellor. I mean, I had about a year when I could actually say what I thought. But, but yeah, it's tricky. And what about you with music? I mean, do you love all kinds of music? I know you have a very wide taste, but...
Well, I do love all kinds of music. Well, not all kinds of music. Many kinds of music. I grew up with classical music, of course, but also, you know, my cousin Judy Friesen, she was a little older than us, and I was very close to her brother David, my cousin David Friesen, who was the president of Friesen's for many years. And Judy belonged to the Columbia Record Club. And so we would listen, David would steal her records. We would listen to Mahalia Jackson, you know, and Miles Davis, and people like that. And so I got a lifelong love of jazz and other things. And I had, you know, you would hear sometimes on the streets of Altona on a Saturday night, you would hear bluegrass music, you know, and country music. And I still have kind of an affection for that as well. I'm a little critical about some of it, and what works better than others, but for sure. And so, yeah, so all kinds of music, but I've had to interview composers whose music I hated, you know, and then you just have to, that's part of the discipline.
It is.
You know, of being a broadcaster, being, you know, and you have to be fair, you know. But probably the toughest interview I ever had was with Jesse Norman, and this was in Minnesota. It was really tough because she was in a dreadful mood, and she was a diva already, Jesse Norman, but she was in a dreadful mood. And she was making life difficult for everyone. And so she was very reluctant. I was just taping an interview for the broadcast, for that weekend's broadcast of the Minnesota Orchestra. And I thought, and so she was very reluctant. She sat down and glared at me. And I thought, how am I going to handle this? And I had a bunch of questions, you know. But I thought, this isn't going to cut it. So I thought to myself, so I took a leap, and it was entirely a leap. I said, I think that you have a special way with vocal music because as a black person, you speak the language in a particular way. And I could hear, see her getting even angrier at me. And I said, brilliantly, or saving my bacon, I said, think Martin Luther King. You know, when he says the phrase, and the lion lays down with the lamb, he says, and the lion lays down. You know, and I don't know where that came from, Sheila, but suddenly she said, well, that's a great compliment, she said, and then we had a program. But, you know, it was just a relief. And sometimes you have to go right to the edge, right to the very edge, and sometimes you fall off and you don't think of anything. I mean, you always think of something.
No, you made me think about an interview that I had with Etta James. And Etta James, a great blues singer, had just started coming back from years of addiction. And the script that I had was, in fact, all about addiction. So I started with, you know, when did you start using? After two questions, she just looked at me and said, why do we want to talk about this? This is the past. I'm now in the present building on my future. And then she said, why don't we just talk chick to chick? And I thought, we have so much in common, sure. But you know what she did? And I just thought, this was so generous. She said, let's compare what's in our purses. So we got our purses out on the table, and she had pictures of her grandkids, and I think I had a beard trimmer, actually. Well, it wasn't mine.
Why was it?
Well, I was living with it.
Nice.
But it was a good reminder to remember people don't always want to talk about the bad stuff. And I think we have a bit of a predilection for that as journalists, you know?
Yeah, we go for the dark side.
We go for the dark side, exactly.
Yeah.
That's right.
And sometimes you have to, because that's part of your obligation to the audience who wants to know certain things, right? You have to ask the questions to them they want to hear. But let's talk about book clubs for inmates.
Let's do that.
Let's talk. Yeah. I mean, we're here at an event that is all about book clubs for inmates, sponsored. And
Well, let me talk. You've had way more experience than I have. I had my first book clubs for inmates as a volunteer last Friday. But what got you interested to begin with?
Well, I'll tell you honestly. Tom Vest mentioned Carol Finley, who started book clubs for inmates. And she started at Collins Bay. And I had just left the CBC. And she had a co-host who didn't work out. And so she asked me to join. And the reason I did, partly I was doing good, I figured, all of that stuff. But frankly, I did it because I was scared to go into a prison. The fear of prisons, you know, this is a center of prisons, right, in this part of the world. And I, you know, from movies and everything, I just was scared to go into, and I thought, I've got to deal with this. So I'm going to do, that was one of the sort of personal reasons. In addition to thinking, I just assumed that this was a good idea. So that's
but is fear something that has motivated you through your life?
Yeah, I think so. I think so. I mean, I think one has one can achieve things by overcoming fears. You know? This was a challenge, because when you first walk into a prison, anybody of the volunteers here will know this. I mean, it's formidable, intimidating. Steel doors open, they close, and you go to another one, they open and they close. And then you're walking down a hall and you're meeting all these guys, some of whom look like pretty tough customers. So that was part of the initial meeting. But then, of course, as soon as I got into it, I just felt compelled to continue because these men in prisons have so little to light up their lives, so little. And so the chance to read a book, but more importantly, to talk about it, to have adult conversations, to come off the range where you have to be all macho and protective and have a human interaction is just, as soon as you experience this. I remember early on in the book clubs, this was in a meeting at Collins Bay, and we were discussing the kite runner. And one of the big questions in the kite runner is, can you ever be forgiven for something terrible that you've done? And you know, when we asked the question of the men, I would say about 75% of them said, no, I cannot be forgiven. Well, then you can have a real conversation. And Carol, who was an Anglican priest, of course, was very good at that. I was a neophyte in talking like that to these guys. I mean, what am I going to say to them? But in talking about it, they began to understand and accept themselves. And so that was very powerful. And I'll never forget, you know, we once were able to do, remember how we always did at the CDC, we did these readings of Christmas Carol at Christmas, and many of you will have known they did in Kingston for many years. We did it all over Canada. And we did one in Collins Bay. It wasn't just the book club that came, it was open to everyone in the prison. And I'll never forget, we would do a couple of readings, and Michael Enright was there, Judy Madrin was there, and myself, and you know, a couple of other people. Harold Redikoff played a little tinny organ thing, and we sang carols in between chapters. And there was this fellow sitting in front of me, and we were on the stage like this, and there were guys right up to the stage. And he was the toughest looking customer you'd ever want to meet, tattooed, you know, all over the place. And when we announced Silent Night, he said, "That's my favorite carol." I mean, I'm getting emotional just remembering that, because, you know, I didn't know this guy. He wasn't in the book club. But for a moment, he had an experience of transcendence. I don't know what. And that's what we do.
photographs for anybody. It's on